From the University at Buffalo School of Social Work, welcome to the In Social Work podcast. I'm Peter Sabota. Thanks for joining us, everyone. Despite a number of biopsychosocial challenges, many cis and transgender queer men find a way to resilience, strength, and joy, both within themselves and in their communities. The broader society remains a complex place. For example, on December 4th, the United States Supreme Court heard a case, and from the sounds of it, appears likely to support a Tennessee law that bans gender-affirming care for minors. A reminder that rights and agency for this community remains a work in progress and aspiration. On today's show, our guest Raheem Thawer brings his unique perspective as a social work clinician, writer, advocate, and instructor to examining the challenges and innovations of this population at the intersection of mental health and systemic oppression. Mr. Thawer will draw on his wide experience regarding the drivers of well-being for queer men and what skills they need to thrive in a society that still marginalizes their identity and experiences. He will also describe innovation in queer relationships and the role of politicized social work practice in affirming queer individuals and communities. Raheem Thawer, MSW, RSW, is an instructor and a student in the Doctor of Social Work program at the University of Alabama. Hi, Raheem. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to In Social Work.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Raheem, I don't know what's going on here, but we last month, we also did a podcast featuring a guest from Alabama. So Alabama is clearly the center of the universe. And it's thank you for letting us in. It's good to have you.
You're very welcome. It is a center. I mean, it's the center of my universe. There's a lot going on over here.
Well, that's what our podcast was about. All right, we're not going to talk about that one. That one's already done. Let's talk about you. So again, it's a pleasure to have you. Thanks for taking the time to join us. I usually start before we kind of get into the kind of the nuts and bolts. I always ask guests how they kind of found their way to social work. And also found their way to, what was the path to the topic for discussion today? So if we could do that in a, could you give us the shorter version of that?
Absolutely.
Because I know we have a lot to talk about, but if you're game, I would love to hear you tell your story about, they're usually pretty fascinating.
I'm happy to share.
Beautiful.
I did my undergraduate degree at the University of Waterloo, which is just a short distance away from Toronto, my hometown. And my undergraduate degree was in psychology. I did a double minor in English Lit and Poli-Sci. And I thought throughout the degree that I wanted to be a post-secondary teacher, and I wanted to teach social sciences and English, not a post-secondary. So I wanted to be a high school teacher, a secondary school teacher.
Huh.
And then I kind of got interested in the idea of clinical work and counseling. And so in the last year of my undergraduate degree, I applied for a counseling psychology program, but I didn't get in. And I think it was kind of great that I didn't get in because I went
it
and
it makes sense in the end, right? In
it
hindsight,
does.
It always fits together.
Totally. And so I went and I worked at an organization called the Alliance for South Asian AIDS Prevention. And I only did that for about a year or a year and a half. And I immediately applied to a Master's of Social Work program. And I made the switch from counseling psych to social work because I really wanted to do clinical work or direct client practice in a setting that also acknowledged systemic issues. I wanted to be in a space where we could also learn about, talk about the ways racism and homophobia impact our mental health. And that was back in, so I finished my undergraduate degree in 2008. I began my MSW in 2010 and carried over to the end of 2011. 2-year program. by then I was 24 or 25 when I began my MSW. And by then I had already been out for several years, out in terms of my sexuality and out to my family specifically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, coming out is a big deal, but once you're out, there's a whole other set of challenges. And I think working specifically in LGBTQ communities got me interested in the specific things that affect our mental health. So we all know that coming out can affect your mental health because it's such a big developmental milestone or developmental event. But I was encountering all kinds of other things, like substance use looks different, body image issues. I didn't have body image issues really until I came out, you know? And so over the years, I continued to work in the HIV sector and LGBTQ healthcare. I worked on a family health team for a number of years. And as I was presenting at conferences, we were always talking about things centered around HIV, because that's like that there was an epidemic. And funding, the way funding works is that anything you talk about in relation to gay men in particular, or programs you develop, they often have to be connected to HIV prevention, treatment, and support in some way. Mm-hmm. And while that's very valid, I thought we need to actually talk about a range of things that affect our mental health that are not specific to sexual health and HIV. You know, I think we need to broaden it a bit. And so that's how this book came about. So this book is about, I thought, let's write about the social determinants of mental health for queer guys. And that includes cis and trans guys.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. If we could just back up for a second, my curiosity got piqued in your story. Can I ask you, where did you do your MSW?
Oh, yeah. I did it at the University of Toronto.
You did? Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I did a specialization in mental health and health because that was my my primary interest.
Got it. So I have to tell listeners that, you know, the University of Buffalo, we consider Canada here in Buffalo our neighbor. And, you know, it's literally a 2-minute bridge ride from downtown Buffalo. And Toronto is just a place where many of us just for all of our lives have been going. And it's interesting because I remember going to Toronto when I was young, like a child. Mm-hmm. And I remember it, and who knows, you know, maybe this is just not, this is through the lens of somebody who was quite young, but it struck me as, at least the Toronto my parents took me to, let's put it that way, was a kind of conservative place. And it was also, it also struck me as a kind of religious place too. I just remember there being churches everywhere we went. But the longer we kept going to Toronto, it became, of course, more and more and more cosmopolitan. And then by the time I was probably old enough to understand it, it seemed like Toronto was like on the cutting edge of developing queer community. Do I have that completely wrong, or does that?
No, you're not completely wrong. The LGBTQ community there is really big, you know, and I think we have the same phenomena that you see in a lot of big American cities, mm-hmm. where queer people who maybe don't fit in or find their place in a smaller community, they mm-hmm. will think about moving to the, you know, to the big smoke, as it were. Now, I think a lot of smaller communities and cities have their own pride and their own communities. Yep. But you have to realize that, you know, in Canada, we also don't have as many big cities as you do in America. So, you know, there's like, you know, there's Vancouver, there's Victoria, there's Winnipeg, a medium-sized city. We've got Toronto, mm-hmm. Ottawa, Montreal, and then some East Coast cities. But Toronto's one of the biggest, or the biggest, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's where people want to often go. As far as religious and conservatism, I'm not sure. I find that there are a number of churches in residential communities, and they're spread out around the suburbs, right in downtown Toronto, one of our biggest hospitals, St. Mike's. And mm-hmm. on the west end of Toronto, we've got St. Joseph's. They're both mm-hmm. religiously affiliated. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that they are, I would say that like they offer treatment to a range of people, you know, and they've mm-hmm. become part of a large university hospital network. So I don't see it as being particularly conservative. However,
oh, not anymore. Yeah.
I mean, nowadays the conservatism comes around, you know, which is the same everywhere. Which like it's mm-hmm. about there's debates around sex education.
Yeah,
and there's debates around rising property taxes and things like that.
So, sure. Yeah. That kind of stuff, fiscal conservatism. Yeah.
Fiscal conservatism and anxiety is it's around those kinds of things.
All right. Well, thank you for indulging that. So you have you know, part of what caught our attention was the book that you mentioned that I don't believe has quite been released yet as we sit here, or has it?
Correct.
Okay, it's still waiting. Yeah,
it's still waiting. It comes out June 1st. Of 2025, which is, you know, Pride Month for a lot of folks mm-hmm. in North America. Mm-hmm. And we just thought that would be like a fitting time to have this book.
And I think you've already told us why you wrote it, but I also get the impression, just looking at the outline of the book, is that this is a self-help guide. This is a book, I think, and this is what I want to check out with you, that is, I think, geared toward the public. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
Okay. Can I ask you why you took that route?
Yeah. You know, I wanted, in many ways, I wanted to take my own experiences and what I'd seen in a clinical setting. Uh-huh. And I wanted to get the idea and the concept in the public, right, around our determinants of mental health. And then I also wanted to democratize mental health interventions. So, you know, the subtitle of the book is Skills to Cope and Thrive as Your Authentic Self. Mm-hmm. And for me, the kinds of interventions I do and the kinds of modalities I'm interested in are cognitive behavioral therapy, psychodynamic approaches mm-hmm. and inquiry, and Gestalt interventions, Gestalt ways of thinking. And mm-hmm. so I combined those three in this book. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool if people could look at determinants of mental health, like shame or internalized shame, coming out, your family of origin, aging, and then be presented with the issue and how it affects your mental health outcomes, and then be given concrete exercises that you can engage in to think about how you're affected by these determinants.
Got it. All right. So before we jump fully into that, yeah. I want to ask you just one more thing, because I think you have a unique perspective, mm-hmm. At least from the folks that we usually talk to. So you are a Canadian citizen, but mm-hmm. you're also embedded in the United States, and you are in, you know, one of our states that is really a hotbed of political conservatism, and yes. and you might have read we had an election recently here in the States. I don't know if you caught that, but
I
so
heard something about
yeah
it.
you might have heard it mentioned. Yeah, so you know, as a Canadian citizen, and I know you teach it in Alabama too, mm-hmm. so you're a Canadian citizen, you're an instructor, and you're also in a doctoral degree program yeah. in Alabama. I'm wondering how you see your work, the book that will come out quite soon, in the light of the recent election here in the States, mm-hmm. and really the movement really in a lot of Western countries yeah. toward, you know, kind of far right authoritarian leaders who are not necessarily the friendliest folks mm-hmm. to the community that you write about and work with and are a member of. So I'm just wondering, like, what if you would just give us, maybe if you want to, you can pass entirely. I'm just curious how you're thinking about these days.
Yeah. You know, I think what America is experiencing right now, in terms of like this red wave mm-hmm. yeah. is a foreshadowing of what we're going to be experiencing in Canada. Mm. Essentially it being here is preparing me for what's to come, I think. Mm-hmm. And in both places, there is huge risk to current protections being rolled back, and there being limits to how we see what I would consider basic human rights. And I know from my lived experience and the people I work with, even when, you know, queer and trans people are represented in popular media, even when we have rights entrenched in a charter or a constitution, growing up in a cis heteronormative world still means that we struggle in unique ways. We're still marginalized in unique ways. And so if you have liberal progressive policies, we're still struggling because we're dealing with growing up in a straight world that tells us we're not okay, that we're sinful, that we're bad, yes, that we're not normal, all of that. And so when I think about this red wave, my concern is that we're going to be dealing with these issues for much, much, much longer, right? And there's going to be a desire and a need based on safety for people to not explore what their authentic self is, even, right? For fear of, rejection, violence, incarceration. I don't know. It can look like so many things.
Yeah.
And so I'm deeply concerned about that. I also think that, frankly, I know that this country is really divided in like red and blue, but I think by and large, there are lots of people that care about affordable living, and they care about living in conditions that feel sustainable.
Yep.
And I think those are social work issues and those are social policy issues. And if you remove the political strategy of scapegoating groups and people for those problems, we're actually, a lot of us are on the same page about what we want. And so if we could stop being mad at each other for our political affiliations and think about how to hold politicians more accountable to giving us a more sustainable life, we could get a lot further. And I think that's going to be the work of the next 4 years, because research actually already shows us that immigrants aren't to blame for increased crime rates. You know, there's a lot of research that already shows that the kind of scapegoating that's happening is not rooted in anything. So it's just going to take, unfortunately, a bit longer for people to get there. But when they do, and I hope they do, I think the issue is really holding our politicians accountable. Like, you know, instead of funding wars, please fund housing. People have the money is there. The money is there to give people housing and food. And so we've bought into some other story. But our needs are clear. People need healthcare. It's not just queer and trans people that need adequate healthcare. Everybody needs that.
Mm-hmm. But of course, and thank you for even going there, quite frankly,
of course, Raheem. Yeah.
But I think of course folks that are marginalized in any society bear the brunt or the stronger brunt of these struggles that we have as a society. But yeah, I do appreciate your perspective. So that said, I'm going to ask, I think, a pretty simplistic question and just let you take off about something that you're passionate about. I hope is that could you spend some time talking about your sense of what kind of skills queer men need to thrive in the society we were just talking about, you know, that despite some gains, continues to marginalize their identity and their experiences. Cause I know you refer to these as the social determinants of mental health, but I guess I wanted to open it up larger than that.
Yeah, and no, I appreciate that question. I think the specific skills first and foremost is being able to understand your own story up against like a template or a map of the kinds of things that affect your mental health, right? So not everybody is going to think about how the process and the experience of coming out has left an imprint on their lives. So coming out isn't just an event. It starts at a young age when you when a lot of people anticipate rejection, right? So I want us to be thinking about, how young was I when I first worried that my family, my community, and my peers would say that I'm not enough, or that I'm not man enough, or that I'm going to be punished by God, or that they sent us a message that if we don't have a family that looks like theirs, we're going to disappoint them, right? Those are all the underpinnings of what internalized shame looks like, or anticipating rejection looks like when we think about coming out or grow up in a straight world. So there's a skill there around just identifying what we've internalized from the outside world, and then thinking about how much of that still sticks with us after coming out. So it's breaking down the illusion that just because I came out and I have a party and I feel great about being shirtless at a dance party, which is fun, one should do that, but I still carry the weight of shame, or, the weight of fearing disappointment, something in the book that I call milestone heteronormativity. Like when my straight counterparts are reaching certain milestones in their lives, such as, buying property, getting married, or having long-term partners, having children. There's so many things that are going to get celebrated, which are nice. They ought to get celebrated. But if my trajectory as a queer person looks different, what are my milestones? And how am I going to feel when I'm in the presence of their milestones, and when my milestones aren't identified, acknowledged, or then celebrated, right? So this is a skill. The skill set here is thinking about, like, what are the things that affect my mental health? And then it's about how do I continue to operate in this world without pretending that I'm completely liberated, to recognize, how the world still works against me in some ways. And the ways that it might work against me are also embedded in queer community, right? So, for example, a lot of queer guys, cis gay men in particular, might be really concerned about body image and how they look and musculature, or weight loss for some. To me, that sounds like, because we see such a difference in emphasis between straight and queer communities, it's clear to me that that's community specific, and we have to think about, what does that mean? Is it grieving masculinity? Is it fear of aging? Is it compensating for not having the same milestones as straight counterparts do? Is it equating our worth to a certain physique because we're embedded in a culture of fat phobia, and having, a sculpted physique means we're disciplined? There's so many things to think about. So there's no one way to think about it, but we're dealing with it in a different way. And so we ought to think about where this came from and how do we engage with it? If you go to the gym 5 times a week and you feel great about your body, amazing. I don't want you to stop that. There's a lot of us for whom that model doesn't fit. And there's some people who have done that, but don't necessarily feel more worthy or like their relationships are any richer necessarily. And I want us to think about that.
Absolutely. And later, I in our kind of pre-podcast discussion, you mentioned innovation, and I want to get to that.
Yeah.
But I think that's the light bulb that just went over while I was listening to you just now.
Yes.
So you also mentioned something called disenfranchised grief.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just kind of flesh that out a little bit?
Absolutely. So this isn't a theory I've come up with. It's well noted in the literature. As we know, grief is a response to loss, right? And grief can take many forms, but there's many kinds of grief that are unacknowledged or disenfranchised, meaning people around us might not always appreciate that a loss has taken place. And so therefore, we don't have the opportunity to, in our social and cultural settings, acknowledge or process that kind of grief. a common example people give is the grief you feel when a loved one is incarcerated. You know, it's hard to talk about the grief you feel of losing that person because their behavior or their life, their whole being has become stigmatized. If somebody you're in a relationship with passes, but you're not married to that person, you would also feel a kind of unacknowledged or disenfranchised grief. Mm-hmm. Losing a pet is a common form of disenfranchised grief. Now, when it comes to queer guys, I think there are many kinds of grief that are disenfranchised. Many of us are in relationships that aren't recognized because not everyone is getting married. Not everybody sees that as an option. I think we are one of a number of communities that are embarking on or bringing a lot of innovation to what the landscape of relationships looks like. So, for example, it's very common for gay men in relationships to be non-monogamous or to be, and that can look like open relationships or polyamory. But when those relationships experience challenges where there's ruptures, there's conflicts, there's breakups, people on the outside are often going to say, like, they're just not going to recognize that. They're going to kind of look at us. And I've had people, when I was in a non-monogamous relationship and we were having challenges, a straight friend of mine said, you know, I think maybe like, you just need to commit to each other and settle down, you know, and like really serious about it. And I said, oh, there's something that's missed here. I love my partner dearly. This is not about not loving my partner. This is about something we both want. And it is highlighting kind of a gap, or it's highlighting an insecurity in our relationship. And we want to work through that insecurity. We don't want to make it go away. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we were to close the relationship and the model was open to the model of openness was important to us, then we'd be grieving something else, right? You'd be mm-hmm. grieving not having the possibility of exploration and expression that is seen in our community as like quite central and important. Mm-hmm. So disenfranchised grief can look like many things. I think, you know, for a lot of folks who I've worked with who struggle with substances, in particular, you know, like heavy alcohol use or crystal meth use, one of the things people will talk about is pairing substances with sex mm-hmm. and those substances allowing them to feel free and to have access to people, sex, bodies, connection. And it's a kind of connection a lot of people feel like they don't otherwise get. And if you ask, why don't you otherwise get it? They'll say things like ageism, racism, femphobia, but also, oh, I missed out. I missed out because I came out late in life. I missed out because I was struggling with coming out while other people were in relationships. So it's kind of interesting to me because then we're thinking about substance use, body image, all of these kinds of things that are not really, they're about those things, but they're also about a sense of loss. They're about grief. There's a longing for connection, and going to the gym a lot or using substances becomes your conduit. It becomes a really strategic thing that you can use to give you access to people and connection. And it alleviates, it mitigates some of the loss you've experienced. So to me, I think we need to complicate, you know, the idea of like, if somebody says I'm struggling with crystal meth, you could talk about, you know, the stages of change that is important. You could talk about, you know, harm reduction goals, but please, we also need to talk about disenfranchised grief. Mm-hmm. And people who want to reduce their substance use, they're talking about losing the community then that they felt close to when they use substances.
And what is going to, you know, you take that away, what fills that need, that connection, if you will?
Yes.
And it's kind of like, and traditional approaches don't address that. I, you know, I don't think they do that for hetero populations. And so the fact that that's probably not even on the radar. not surprising, but also equally as sad, given how fundamental, you just spoke
Yeah,
to it.
absolutely. And if we think about, going on substances, if we talk about substances as a way to keep you connected to people, A, it's serving a very important function. If it becomes a problem and you try to reduce that problem or the symptom, so you try to reduce your substance use, if it's become a problem, you have to address what's left. Now, part of what's left is going to be, difficulty with self-esteem, anxiety, depression, potentially past traumas come up,
Trauma, yeah.
but also deep isolation that comes from dissatisfaction. Like, a lot of people are unhappy in their working environments. They're unhappy that they can't get jobs, or ha unhappy that they can't be out their authentic selves in their workplaces, in their families. They're feeling a lot of, like, there's a lot of disenfranchised grief I see with people in their, between their mid-30s to like late 50s, often, where they're like, where do I fit in? I'm not necessarily having a family in the traditional sense. I live in a city and I'm perpetually single, and that can be okay, but I feel sadness around that because I thought my life would look different. And I think being single for your entire life can be fine, but yeah, it could bring up sadness for a lot of us.
Absolutely. Thank you. Again, I'm going to ask another kind of broad question. So what, in your opinion, are the drivers of well-being for queer men, and given their unique needs?
Yeah, thank you for that. I think by and large, there's lots of research that shows a sense of belonging is really, really important for lots of people's well-being. For queer guys, I think if we were to think about belonging and also a sense of self, like feeling good about who you are, we need to talk about community support and your barriers to being around people like yourself. If I think about men that I've worked with who are not out, they're not out, and that presents a barrier to meeting other people right off the bat. And what they are struggling with and what gets in the way of their sense of belonging is fear of rejection. And if we go deeper, okay, well, if you do experience rejection from one community, what would be a barrier from being connected to another community? A thing that will sometimes come up is, well, I'm not quite like them, meaning I'm quite not like other gay men. And you would say, okay, well, tell me about what's different in you compared to them. I'm not as feminine. They're feminine, I'm not, so I don't really fit in. And so to me, that actually sounds like internalized homophobia more than not being accepted by feminine gay men. But, I think there's a worry about being attached to a community that has been labeled or tagged as being deviant, having like the stigma of AIDS and the legacy of AIDS attached to us. I think for a lot of people, the idea of a long-term relationship with another man, it feels intriguing, but also perverse. I think it brings up a kind of disgust, and that is part of the internalized homophobia, right? Like, there's this desire I have, but how can I be all of these things? So that's some people. It's not everybody, right? That's a subsect of people. But if we're talking about belonging for that community, these are some of the barriers. For other folks, if we think about, if you think about a gay man in popular culture, for a lot of people, it's the Queer as Folk kind of gay man. Queer as Folk was a popular TV show. And it's like, these guys who go to the gym together, they live in a city, they live in Pittsburgh in that show. And that show is like 30 years old now. But they go to the gym, they go dancing on the weekend, their community spot is the bar. And that is the story for many people. However, a lot of our barriers are like trying to figure out how to participate in this subculture. So we live in a subculture where sex is celebrated and prioritized because the kind of sex we're having And our sex in general is what has been politicized. It's been labeled as a vector of illness. It's been labeled as unnatural. AIDS has been labeled as a punishment from God. All of this kind of nonsense. So we're in this subculture where we're trying to figure out how to connect with each other. And we say sex is important. Well, how do you get sex? If you go on an app, we are going to be evaluated by our body types, because that's how apps work.
Yep.
So then we think that, you know, there could be 100 of us in just a 2-mile radius, but we're not going to hang out with each other or see each other because we're looking at these metrics that makes us think about who do I want to be around, right?
Yeah.
And so when I talk to guys who are in, you know, big cities like Toronto, and they come to therapy and they're like, I'm lonely, or relationships are hard, we come up against what I would call the landscape of connection seeking. And I think it's not talked about often enough. I'll say it again. So, it's not about whether you're in a relationship or not. Mm-hmm. It is the landscape of connection seeking. It is the unique things we encounter when we are seeking casual sex and long-term relationships. Mm-hmm. So for example, if you are looking for a long-term relationship or you're in one, you might look at the communities around you and say, oh, am I missing out on singleness? Is my relationship a barrier to experiencing other things? You might be single and saying, okay, I'm able to have a lot of casual sex, but it's hard to meet somebody, you know, that wants to have a long-term relationship. So people are feeling a kind of loss on both sides of this. And then there are people who are able to incorporate many sides of this into their lives, but they also don't have a script. They don't have a model for how this looks like. They're trying to figure it out, right? Yeah,
everything's hidden. It's
yeah. Mm-hmm. And I meet a lot of guys who they'll complain, they'll be angry at the gay community. They're like, nobody wants to be in a relationship. Everyone just wants sex. And I'll say, actually, I think we need to reframe this. Don't be mad at your peers. Let's think about how we are at the forefront of innovation in relationships. And what we really need to figure out is what our barriers are in this landscape of connection seeking, right? Because I think there's a lot of things that get in the way. So if we're looking at a dating grid and that grid is about body types, why are we focused on that? Well, certain bodies represent power. They represent dominance. They represent masculinity. And so my question is, in what ways is proximity to that body or a person of that race, that height, that caricature, why did that become so important to you? What does it represent to be able to have sex with somebody like that? And how does an ongoing valorization of that body type and that racial group prevent you from meeting other people that could be very worthy relationship partners?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, I think I have one more question that I want to make, or one more area that I want to make explicit. And I think you've addressed it along the way, but I do want to just give it its own space in terms of drivers of well-being and also unique needs. And that's around health.
Yeah.
What, if you haven't said everything you already want to say about that, what would you say is unique about the health needs?
Well, there's a lot of gay men and LGBTQ people at large that don't have adequate access to healthcare. And I was just talking to a social work class today about the concept of accessibility. It's not about having a doctor that exists within a few mile radius. Accessibility is about, are they going to understand me? Are they going to ask the right questions? Am I going to feel judged? And when I access their service, like, am I talking to people who are like me or at least understand me, right? Exactly. Because we want to be able to talk about very specific things, right? I want to be able to talk about the interaction between my antidepressant and potentially using MDMA on the weekend. Like, that needs to not be a big deal. Right? That needs to not be a big deal. Or people need to be able to talk about the interaction of like their HIV medication and another substance they might be using. We need to be able to talk about choosing to have condomless sex and also being able to get STI testing without the judgment in between. You know, when straight people have condomless sex, it's just called sex.
Yeah, you beat me to it.
Yeah, but when gay people have condomless sex, it's like barebacking and it's risky and it's an epidemic and all of this stuff. And like, sure, some for there's going to be a portion of people who are experiencing a kind of vulnerability because, you know, for systemic reasons, they feel like they can't insist on safer sex practices that they're comfortable with, or they want a certain kind of safer sex measure like condoms, for example, but they might forego those because they are going to prioritize in that moment connection over insisting on something because you don't want to be rejected and you don't want to lose out on that opportunity. We need healthcare professionals who just kind of understand that. That's not groundbreaking really, you know, but we need people who kind of get that. I think for our trans kin, you know, they need healthcare services that are really gender affirming. And if they're like the demographic I'm speaking to in my book is guys into guys, you know, so trans guys who are into guys, they're operating in a really unique space where a lot of folks will have had a lot of queer community that's more on the sapphic side, like having, you know, more queer women as friends, potentially. And then they're in a community where they're seeking other men. And so they're also hanging out with like, or operating in cis gay men's culture. The ways people talk about safety, consent, safer sex are really wildly different in these two communities. And so healthcare professionals need to be aware of how to support that community, and to also be able to talk about things like the impact of hormone replacement therapy on sexual pleasure, for example, you know? So I think healthcare and adequate healthcare is about access. It's knowledge, it's not being stigmatized, but it's also about subcultural knowledge and an understanding of like what's important to us and what we need. And then being able to get some of that stuff in a timely manner, you know? Does that answer it? Or were you looking for something else under health?
No, that's it. That's really it.
I will say one more thing. And it's just about a year ago, I started facilitating this monthly group for gay men and queer guys who are affected by cancer. And that group, it's a small group, but there's so much isolation because they talk about A, having difficulty in the dating relationship sphere, and even with challenges in their relationships, if they're in a long-term one, to talk about the changes that they experience around radiation, chemotherapy, and if they're going to get a surgery and have a prostate removed, they're finding by and large, physicians or specialists are not talking about the impact on sex and sexuality. And that's quite important. I'm sure that's important to straight folks too, but gay men are more like, no, we need to talk about this. And the people they're asking they're not bad humans. They just don't know. And then they're finding that the services, like they're just not quite, they're not adequate. So it's really challenging.
Well, that, you know, what's running through my head as I listen to you talk is, you know, we're talking, you know, I hope that there are physicians who are angels out there, right? Who get it. And or if they don't get it, they're like open to being, to learning. Imagine that, learning from your patient, if you will. And just saying what you don't know. But I'm thinking about just how hard it is, you know, to find a physician, no matter who you are, even if you have all the benefits of being, you know, in the so-called, I don't know what to call it, dominant culture, or whatever.
Yeah.
But like, where would queer people find other than in their own community?
Absolutely.
Where these people are, you know, where are these docs? And I would imagine that you have a number of poor experiences.
I think people do have a number of poor experiences. However, I will say, I think LGBTQ communities are also quite resilient and they're like, it's really interesting, like how people will find an LGBTQ group wherever they are, or they'll find the bar and they'll find, you know, the poster that says there's this thing happening, and they'll find the healthcare center, and they'll just find some of the things they need to connect with people. And they'll get connected to services that way. But is there like a well laid out system navigation plan? No, but people do tend to figure those out. I will say one thing, which is, you know, America is very privatized in their healthcare, though there are some public clinics that accept, you know, Medicaid. And so like a government sponsored kind of insurance, but Canada is moving in that direction too. And I think one of the biggest downfalls is that there's less accountability in a private sector. I think if we're all public, we can say, you know, there are core competencies that you need. And those core competencies include working with marginalized communities. And I worry we'll lose that if we move toward a public model. So I just want to put that out there, that like that's a huge benefit of a public model. More accountability, more standardized training. And like we tell everybody, like trans healthcare is healthcare. So everybody should know about that. Just like every doctor is going to know about, they're going to know something about ADHD and diabetes, right? So they don't have to be an expert, but they have to know something.
Absolutely. So I'm starting to get nervous because we're bumping up against the clock already, which is not
stressful.
Yeah, it's stressful, but it just happens all the time. Let's get to the innovation piece, because when we spoke briefly before we agreed to do the podcast together, you've like made it a professional and even as part of your training and research, an important thing for you. And that's innovation in queer relationships. I'm not sure everybody understands, including me, by the way, what that means.
Okay. So at a baseline, I think it is taking what we already talk about, which is a common experience of non-monogamy in relationships and some like unconventional relationship structures. So for example, you know, I have a friend who's dating somebody who used to be married to a woman and has two kids. And now the friend is co-parenting with his partner, these two kids, and those two kids also see, you know, their mom in like a shared custody. And so I think there is a kind of, there's a way that we're already living that is unconventional, not scripted. And instead of thinking about it as it from a deficit model and thinking like, ooh, non-monogamy is about promiscuity and it is pervasive in our communities. Like, that's silly. Let's think about it as we're paving a new way that is inherently resisting oppressive structures that have told us how to be, right? Like, I don't know why people are like straight communities in particular, no offense, you know, but they're just adamant on like getting married. Like, why are people so adamant on doing a thing that has a 50% failure rate? If there was a 50% chance that your vacation destination was going to have a volcano erupt and a hurricane, would you go? You know? So while people are running toward the disaster, I think for a lot of us folks, we judge ourselves harshly for not fitting that mold, but actually we need to frame it as innovation. And when frame it as innovation, we can say to ourselves, okay, there's a new norm in our community, but also when we come up against that norm, we have other challenges, right? Mm-hmm. So there is the idea of what you see an ideal relationship structure looking like. So I might say my ideal model is non-monogamy. Now, when I meet somebody, how do I know when to tell them that? And if my non-monogamy is politicized, I see it as resisting an oppressive structure, then somebody who says, oh, you know, I want to be monogamous and maybe I want to get married one day and I want to have kids, am I going to judge them? Mm-hmm. That's what we need to talk about. How can I create space for that person and not think about them as less than? And for that person who wants that, if they want monogamy, how we could at least have a few dates and think about what our connection is like and worth, because I would be willing for someone to say, like, you know, for me to think about under what conditions and in what circumstances might I be willing to be monogamous. I don't think that you meet somebody and you decide right away that we're going to be committed and then all the growth happens from there. If we were to follow that model, that would be called arranged marriage.
Yes. Anyway.
So yes. I don't think anyone is thinking about commitment on the date. So I think we need some space to talk about our preferred model and then what that could look like with the other person and give ourselves some space to figure that out, you know, and to think about what flexibility could look like. And then if we are going to be non-monogamous, I think it's that people don't know what that could look like. So we need to talk about what are the rules? Everyone says communication is key, but look, communication doesn't guarantee anything. It just guarantees that you're saying something. But what are you saying? What are you asking for? What are the limits? What happens if we can't follow these so-called rules? Those are the conversations we need to be having in the context of innovation.
Yeah. And yeah, thanks. And I know that you use evidence-based practices in your work. And I know you're partial to, I think you're a CBT and psychoanalytic models.
Yes.
But I have to admit, as I, especially in the last like 5 minutes, and I don't know if this is your thing, but for me, the fit with narrative therapy is just really, at least to me, sounds like a really good fit. You know, separating yourself from those dominant narratives that exist in the culture. And I've always admired the narrative therapists who I've known or who I've studied, who like from the get-go talk about separating themselves from that. And from the get-go, it's like, okay, this is external. This might not be your meaning. And that sounds like a very good fit, at least to me, with many of the things you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, narrative therapy has become very popular.
Yeah, it's the
And I think there, if we zoom out for a second, there's some similarities with psychoanalysis. There is a strong emphasis on the subjectivity.
Yes.
Of the other person. We want to know their story and their inner world. And when something occurs, we're also in both camps interested in exploring the meaning of that phenomena, the incident, the experience. And both could be used to deconstruct dominant discourses. I think it's more forthcoming in narrative therapy. It's more explicit.
Right.
Whereas in a psychoanalytic frame, I might say, okay, unconsciously, you're doing this thing that's quite stigmatized and you feel not great about it. You know, I'm thinking about how, you know, from an id, ego, drive perspective, you're coming up against a dominant narrative. And so I think there's different ways that I think both models can maybe approach similar issues.
Exactly. Yeah. And also there, and then we'll just leave this alone. What I also like about the narrative approach is that it is like overtly political. They're going to go there straight away. And that makes sense given a lot of the things that you said. So we are definitely running out of time. So I want to thank you, number one, for taking the time to talk with us. You've minimally had me thinking about a lot of things, and it reminded me of something when I, years ago in the beginning of, you know, this is almost 40 years ago, actually, when I was a practicing social worker, I was working in chemical dependency. Yes. And as you mentioned, you know, if things are bad now, 40 years ago, things were a hell of a lot worse, you know, but I remember I had a client who was gay and he brought me a book one day. And I still remember it. It was called Loving Someone Gay.
Yes.
And it was just a wonderful gift that he gave me. And it was like, you know, if you want to understand me, Peter, here's a path for you. Here's a framework. And I actually think that your book is going to serve I think it's going to serve all sorts of purposes. But I don't think its application and utility is going to be limited to, you know, queer men as well. So I'll give you the last word, Raheem. Is there anything that you'd like to say to kind of take us out here?
Yeah. Look, I appreciate conversation. And so conversation is about important issues that affect our lives, is addressing the social determinants of our health and mental health, because it nurtures and cultivates community and a sense of belonging. And when we see ourselves reflected in others, or other people hear our stories, we get a lot of our like very important self-object needs met, which a lot of us are longing for. Mm-hmm. So these conversations are important. I think we need to keep having them. When my book comes out in June, I am planning to do a few, you know, book promotion events. And so I'm hoping to have some nice conversations in those as well. So if people are following me on social media, you can look out for that. So, you know, if I'm in a city mm-hmm. that you're in, mm-hmm. maybe you'll show up. That could be sweet.
Yeah, that would be sweet. And we can put some of these links in our show notes for listeners who would maybe like to learn about you know, the title of Raheem's book and some other ideas. We can link those in our show notes. Raheem, thank you again. It was a pleasure to talk with you, and thank you again for taking the time.
Absolutely. Take care.
The In Social Work podcast team is our web and tech guru, Steve Sturman. Ryan Trofe, our GA production assistant. Say hi, Ryan.
Hello.
And me, Peter Sabota. All of us wish you a reflective holiday season. In fact, we wish everybody a bunch of goodwill all year round. Hey, you can now listen to our podcast on YouTube. I'm going to leave that right there. See you next time, everybody.